right. I'm here to introduce Debbie Goddard. She is the Director of Campus and Community Programs at the Center for Inquiry and the Director of African Americans for Humanism. Before working for CFI, she participated in local free thought groups in the Greater Philadelphia region and helped organize and support campus groups internationally as a student volunteer. She has also been involved with progressive organizing, community activism, and LGBTQ issues. She started working at CFI in 2006 as a field organizer, utilizing her grassroots organizing experience to support campus and community groups across the country and around the world. In 2012, she became CFI's Director of Outreach, and she now oversees CFI's U.S. branches and the International Campus Outreach Initiative. Here is Citizen Skeptic with Debbie Goddard.
Hello. How does it sound? Good so far? Flatterer. I'm doing an unusual topic today and possibly an ambitious talk, but that's exciting. I usually talk about organizing and outreach, things like diversity initiatives, how to get more people of color involved in your groups, how to reach women, how to reach students better, how to organize campaigns, things like that. This is about how we think about our movement, how we think about our activism, and how we think about our values, who they're good for. And I mentioned to the organizers that I have a lot of content, and I hope I don't go over time, so I will not bore you with more background information, but just get started. Fortunately, a lot of what I'm saying is reinforcing points that were brought up in talks last night, so I can skip a couple of things early on. The talk is called Citizen Skeptic, and I won't quite tell you what that means yet. I'll tell you halfway through. You'll figure it out. But how to be a better skeptic and citizen? It's me as a superhero, Luke Cage. You know the answer to that. So what do I mean by skeptic? What are we talking about when we talk about skepticism? There are two kinds of skepticism, or I should say there are two kinds of ways that we use the term skeptic and skepticism in this movement. My first exposure to the skeptic movement was back in 2000 at a CFI student leadership conference. My first exposure to all of this was in 2000. And my impression was that it was 50% Bigfoot, 20% ghosts, 20% psychics and ESP, and crop circles and other things thrown in. That is one kind of skepticism, defined as applying the methods of science, the tools of science, to address paranormal, pseudoscientific, and fringe science claims. By definition, things that mainstream science doesn't tend to spend a lot of time on or address, like crop circles, like psychics and Bigfoot, kind of a hobbyist field. The way I'm going to be using this term is more like methodological skepticism, using the methods of science, the tools of critical thinking, to evaluate evidence to determine what's likely true and false. But there's another part of this that I think we could do a better job of making explicit. We're not just trying to determine what's true and false, what's likely true and false, because we like being right, although we do like being right. We're trying to use these tools because we think it contributes to a better world, and it contributes to better lives for ourselves and things. So my simplified definition of skepticism that incorporates all this is that it's a method that uses the tools of science and critical thinking to evaluate information so that we can make better, more well-informed decisions. Does that sound right? Is everyone just not awake yet? Okay, let's kick it up a notch. Let me give you an example story. Even though Candace said maybe I shouldn't tell this one. I'm telling it, so I can just demonstrate what I mean. Back in 2011, I lived with a boyfriend. His name was Ian. And you have conversations sometimes when you're dating someone, you're in a relationship, you talk about personal things. And I mentioned the fact that my younger sister had just found this weird blue thing under her skin. and sort of dug it out. She was like, is this a microchip? Is this from the government? I was like, isn't that weird how skin is technically our largest organ, and yet there's so many things that happen that we don't understand? We're just like, what the heck's going on here? You know, what's this? And I mentioned in this conversation that I'd had this weird blackhead. Sorry, this is gross. My parents were nurses, so I don't tend to get grossed out by stuff like this. Apologies. But I had this weird blackhead on my abdomen for years, and I didn't know what it was. And he said, as sometimes the people you're dating don't do, let me get that for you. I get my tweezers. And I was like, nah. And he said, come on. I said, okay. Fine. So he did. I was laying down. He's kind of poking and prodding at this. And at some point, he said, that's weird. I said, what? He said, there's some fibers in here. I was like, what the heck? Fibers. He ended up pulling one out. It was about a centimeter long, kind of translucent or clear like things in this picture. And I was like, what is that? I'm trying not to curse because I realize this is going to be online later. What the heck is that? And I remembered reading online about something that people said they had, the fibers that they found under their skin, and it was called something like Magellans or Morganons or something like that, and I was like, I just read about something online where people find fibers under the skin, and it seems to be all in their head. It's a made-up internet disease. And let's check it out tomorrow. I'll save this thing. We'll look, you know, it's late at night. We'll go to bed. The next morning, he woke me up. He said, I actually looked up what you were talking about. It's called Morgellons. Didn't you have Lyme disease a couple years ago? And I said, yeah, I did. He said, apparently it's correlated with Lyme disease. I was like, what? So we go to Wikipedia, as you do, and we looked up what it said as a starting point for research. And here are some quotes. Although an apparent association of the condition with the presence of Lyme disease has been reported, further research will be needed to help resolve the validity of Morgellons disease. There was more about connecting with Lyme disease. Many patients with Morgellons disease have positive Western blots for Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative agent of Lyme disease. But it went on to say, most doctors regard Morgellons as a manifestation of known medical conditions, including delusional parasitosis. Morgellons patients usually self-diagnose on the internet. And I thought, hey, I feel personally attacked by this relatable content. The internet is important in spreading and supporting bizarre disease beliefs. The World Wide Web has become the incubator for mass delusion, and it, Morgellons, seems to be a socially transmitted disease spread over the internet. One of my coworkers had written an article recently, which I found out the next day at work, about Morgellons, which he ended by saying, Occam's razor principle suggests that Morgellons is a mental disorder. And I thought, crap, I had fibers in my skin. It was probably the result of a delusion spread by the internet, and it's all in my head, and also my boyfriend's head. I have a made-up internet disease. Now, this was only part of my thinking, but I'll admit, I did think this for a minute. Like, perhaps this is legit. I checked out the Morgellons Research Organization, I looked at some photos, and I was just like, maybe this is a thing, because I've never seen anything like this. But I try to be a good skeptic. I try to apply the rules of critical thinking and Occam's razor principles and things. And so I wanted to talk about some of the things I learned from this experience. One, I realized that, of course, when I felt attacked, when I was looking for information about something I didn't know anything about, and the first kinds of things I saw were, you're crazy. It's made up. It's in your head. You're nuts. You're delusional. I was more likely to try to hold on to what I thought might be the case. I felt like I was being dismissed, right? Of course, I tried to do the best research I could. As a skeptic, of course, you try to evaluate information and draw the best conclusions you can. In this case, as in many cases, I needed to be able to depend on authorities I trust. Doctors, dermatologists, skeptical activists who also have medical degrees. And at the end as well, to feel comfortable saying, I don't know. I don't know what the heck that was. Still don't know what that was. It's still there, you guys. It's been like 7 more years. And I don't really care. Skin's complicated. Things are complicated. I don't have any of the other symptoms of this made-up internet disease that people think they have. But it gave me some empathy for people who do present with different symptoms and say, like, what is this? And a little more sensitivity to skeptics who are knee-jerk about saying, that's bullshit, it's in your head. Also, you're crazy. That's the lessons learned from that. Connectedly. Let me tell you another story. I know the light's pretty bright in here, but can you see this picture? This is me in 2012. Every year I go to the Philadelphia Folk Festival. I spend time sitting on a farm field about an hour north of Philadelphia. This year, wearing these sandals, I got a bug bite on the top of my foot. It was a weird bug bite, and I showed a couple people there and said, what do you think this is? Is this a spider bite? I'm not really sure what those look like. You think this is that? Didn't really think much of it beyond that. About 3 weeks later, I woke up one morning, a morning I was supposed to fly to Atlanta, Georgia for a Dragon Con, a big science fiction, fantasy, etc. convention. But I woke up with this very bad and weird headache and neck ache, just concentrated in the back of my head and neck. After laying in bed for a while thinking, what is wrong with me? I realized I'd had this headache once before, when I'd had Lyme disease. And so I thought, maybe that bug bite from a few weeks ago was actually a tick bite, and maybe I have Lyme disease again, and I should go get that checked out when I come back from Atlanta, which I'm flying to in 4 hours. While I was in Atlanta, I woke up every morning with that same kind of weird back of the head, back of the neck ache, and I started getting really worried. I mentioned this to a doctor friend of mine, a skeptic activist actually too, in Atlanta, and she said, oh no, you need to go to the hospital right now. The problem with Lyme disease is if you let it go, you have a much higher chance of having terrible things happen to you, neurological damage, things like that. And that really worried me, but also I was in the midst of a very big conference. I had things to do. I didn't want to go to a hospital in Atlanta. I didn't know how insurance worked in that case. So I thought, you know, in 3 days when I'm back in Buffalo, I'll go first thing. Hopefully nothing bad will happen then. But that night I was laying in my bed in the hostel on my phone looking up symptoms of Lyme disease. And I saw one that really worried me. It's a tick. It's pretty ridiculous, but at this point again I was getting worried, right? Something's gonna happen to me because I didn't take care of this right away. This one picture, it took me a while to find it again, but this one picture really freaked me out. This guy has Bell's palsy. I've met people with Bell's palsy. Bell's palsy is not that bad. You have some a nerve maybe compressed or something inside of your face. It usually lasts a few months and clears up. It was something about the red eyes that got to me. And for some reason, in my worried brain, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to wake up tomorrow, and this guy's face is going to be my face. No, that doesn't make any sense. But that's what I thought. Like, I've ruined my thing. Like, I should have gone to the doctor instead of coming to Atlanta. You know, I'm going to make life harder for myself. I'm going to wake up with Bell's palsy. Well, a few days later, I was back in Buffalo, and I went to a doctor and said, basically, it was a doctor I hadn't seen before because it was a more urgent appointment. I said, I think I have Lyme disease again. I had a bug bite a few weeks ago outside of Philadelphia in a farm field, and I've been getting this headache in the back of my head that I've only gotten before when I've had Lyme disease. The doctor said, it's probably not Lyme disease. It's not that common in this area. Why don't you just wait and see if you develop any other symptoms? And then come back in if you do. Well, my heart rate increased, my blood pressure went up, and I thought, if I walk out of here without getting anything, in the next day or two, my face is gonna turn into this guy's face with the freaky eyes. That's scary. So now I have to figure out how to talk to this doctor. The first thing was to say, I wasn't in this area. I know it's not that common in this area. As I mentioned, I was outside of Philadelphia in a farm field. And having had Lyme disease before, I know that it's very common in the Northeast. Philadelphia is in this blue blob over here that shows the how common Lyme disease is. Buffalo's in that white area in the corner of New York. So it may not be common here, but I was in Philadelphia when this happened, where it's very, very common. She didn't seem happy. I think she thought I was challenging her authority and said, well, since you said you had Lyme disease before, we can't test for it a second time. So you'll just need to see if you develop other symptoms and come back in. And now I think I'm going to die of nervousness because there's a gatekeeper who's keeping me from accessing what I think is very important medical care, or at least important enough to keep me from waking up with this guy's face on my face, which, again, is irrational, but look at his eyes. I was worried. But I had one more piece of information that could help me in this instance, which is that the time before that I'd had Lyme disease was actually the second time I'd had Lyme disease. I'd had Lyme disease. This would make it the third time if indeed I had Lyme disease. That's what happens in Philadelphia, I guess. So I knew that you could actually test to see if you had a new infection. So I laid that down, like, well, actually, I came to this facility a few years ago with Lyme disease and was told you could test for a different infection. Please, let me just get tested to see if I have it. And she actually tried to block me one more time. She said, she frowned and she looked at her notes and she's like, well, it looks like you're due for blood work anyway, so how about scheduling an appointment for a few days to come in because you'll need to fast to do that. And I was like, good thing I haven't eaten yet today, even though it's 1:30 in the afternoon. Like, I can take care of that this afternoon. Let me in. So, indeed, I got tested that afternoon. I did the blood work, and they called me 2 days later and said, hey, you have Lyme disease for the third time. Come on in, pick up your prescription. And I didn't wake up with Bell's palsy, which was good. But this taught me something else. You know, the methods of skepticism are good. Of course, they're good for us. They help us make better health decisions. But if we want to take these steps that are good for us, it doesn't just involve us being right. I was pretty right. I had some information. I tried to make a good decision based on that. Hey, I probably have Lyme disease again. But I needed also to be able to communicate effectively with someone else to benefit myself, right? So part of skepticism, part of trying to be a good citizen skeptic, a skeptic who is part of society and the world, involves also working on our communication skills to help ourselves and to help others. Another story. I learned so much from this. Part of why I'm sharing these stories is because I don't tend to hear this kind of thing talked about a lot in skepticism. Often it's about how we, the skeptics, are right, and they, the irrational people, are wrong about psychics or crop circles or whatever it may be. I enjoy when I get the chance to hear people who've come out of irrational beliefs or wrong beliefs about something and talking about the process they went through to get through that. But also, what I want to talk about here is the pieces around that that are important for us to be good skeptics, good citizen skeptics, good skeptics who are part of society. I rarely hear the category of thing I'll be talking about now discussed in the skeptic movement. So, this happened to me in about 2010. I'd been working at the Center for Inquiry at that point for 4 years, and I was pretty broke. I was broke before I started working at CFI. I had a lot of credit card debt from being in college and not having health insurance and paying for medical things with credit cards and having car repairs and everything else that happens. And when I moved to Buffalo to work for CFI, you know, getting paid nonprofit wages and living in a different city away from family, I was not in a financially good situation for a decent period of time. I had a second job, first delivering pizzas, then as an SAT tutor. And at some point on one cold and snowy day, I got a phone call from a company called East Valley Financial, who's offering some credit card package. If you pay us this much, we'll lower your APRs, you can save so much money. And I said, I don't have the money for that. And they said, well, we can do a discounted rate if you have X amount of credit card debt, but you'll be able to lower your credit card payments. My average APR was something around 26% at the time. And I thought, this sounds scammy. I've gotten this kind of call before. But what if it's not a scam? Well, I'm a pretty smart person. I'm relatively smart. I should be able to read through these documents, and if I give them money and it's scammy, I'll just demand a refund if it's a legit company. I Googled it while she was talking, while the woman speaking to me on the phone, and I decided to give it a shot. As soon as I got the materials in the mail, I read them over and I said, nah, this isn't for me. I followed all of the steps for a refund, faxed in some paperwork, 60 days later, no refund. So I called them. I spoke to someone who's very nice, and I said, you know, I didn't get this money. She said, okay, here's what you should do. Sorry about that, something must have gone wrong. Long story short there, over 10 months, roughly every 10 days, I called, I emailed, I faxed, I called again, I emailed, I asked to speak to managers, I never got my money back. At some point, the phones there just rang and rang and rang. I thought, I've been scammed. I lost money. I feel a little ashamed to tell this story. You know, again, I work at an organization whose job it is literally to promote skepticism and good thinking. But we don't tend to talk about this kind of thing. Not only that, but even telling the story, I remember the feeling that I had talking to this woman on the phone thinking, this is probably a scam. This sounds scammy. Can they even do this? But what if it's not? I felt so stuck. I was in the kind of financial situation where I felt like one small thing could go wrong and I'd sort of fall off of my perch. I'd have to basically take the Greyhound bus back to Philadelphia and move back in my mom's house crying and declare bankruptcy and try to start over. I think about this sometimes in this feeling, which really I'm feeling now actually, sometimes when I hear, for example, skeptics making fun of people for buying lottery tickets. When I lived in a rough neighborhood in Philadelphia when I was a student at Temple University, I saw a lot of people who lived in my building buying lottery tickets. Do you know who it is that buys lottery tickets? It's not, you know, upper middle class people. It's poor people, lower middle class people, working class people, who don't feel like they have a lot of ability to get out of the situation they're in. They feel powerless. But this is an action that they can take that might change their situation. That's where I was when I decided to plunk a couple $100 down to East Valley Financial. And I try to bring that same feeling, that empathy and understanding, when I think about skepticism and when I think about who our values are for and how we can better promote them. My big lesson from that was that to be good skeptics, we need empathy and we need to foster understanding. But skepticism isn't just a tool that benefits us as individuals, whether it be with health decisions or financial decisions or parenting decisions, right? Clearly, it's a tool that we can use to benefit the people we care about. Our friends and our family. If I like skepticism, and I think that it's good, I think that the values are useful, I think that it can help me, I should also be concerned about skepticism and the people I care about. This is my sister. And that's my niece. She's about 2 in this picture. She just turned 6. And on a snowy January day in 2012, they moved in with me. because my sister had lost her job. She was about to get evicted. My roommates had just moved out. So she drove up from Philadelphia to Buffalo with basically whatever she could fit in her Corolla, and her kid, of course, and two cats, and moved into my apartment. I think it was one of the weekends that we had a polar vortex. For you guys in the north, you know how that feels. It was miserable out. It was cold. There was this much snow. It was her driving conditions were terrible. You know, she came in late on a Saturday. We carried in all these things. And Emily, the kid, was so unhappy. She was crying and snot coming out of her face, and she was not feeling well. The next day, we drove to Walmart so Carol could pick up some housewares. As we were in the car driving back and Emily was crying and snotty and coughing and whatnot, Carol, my sister, told me that, you know, there aren't a lot of medicines that you can give to a two-year-old. They're not safe. Kids are too small. But she was able to find something that didn't have any bad side effects because it was homeopathic. And I wanted to hit my brakes and turn around and have her return that. And I was like, it didn't have any bad side effects, of course, because it doesn't have any side effects, Carol, because there's nothing in it. Homeopathic medicine is BS. Let me tell you about it. And oh my gosh, you know, this is the stuff that we do at my job. So of course I'd read articles, I'd seen presentations, I'd read the Wikipedia page. I knew all, like, too much. I knew too much. And for the next 15 minutes, I basically gave her a long lecture about how homeopathic medicine is BS and why. I talked about the lobbying efforts in the 90s to get supplements on the shelves without, you know, they're able to make basically false claims. I talked about the history of homeopathy. And she pushed back a little bit at first. She said, well, if it doesn't do anything, why would they sell it? And I was like, let me tell you why, because of this lobbying effort. And so it was probably not the happiest 15 minutes, but I was so excited that I could use something that I learned at work, and you know, I don't really know people who buy this kind of thing in general, and I was just like, here's all this information, I'm being so helpful right now. We got to the house, and I was like, hold on, I'm going to get my laptop and look up the Wikipedia article so you can take a look. So I go in my office, and I plug things in, I find the article on Wikipedia on homeopathy, and I walk out in the kitchen with my laptop to show her, and she's kneeling on the ground, and giving Emily a spoonful of this medicine. And I thought, what are you doing? I told you, this is BS. You should have returned it. You don't have any money. You lost your job. Like, that was $14 that you should have returned. I would have returned it for you tomorrow. And she said, well, if Emily doesn't get better in 7 days, I'll just call them and ask for a refund. And I said, of course she's going to get better. She has a cold. She's probably going to be fine in 7 days. Or more fine. Well, they're not going to give you... Carol, didn't you listen to anything I said? And this really bothered me for a while, because, again, like, I'm not a professional skeptic, whatever a professional skeptic is, but I professionally interact with skepticism and skeptics. This is making noise. I should have been better at this. You'd think I would be better at this. Why didn't I do this well? Why did I fail at interacting with my sister on something? I mean, again, it's not the most important thing. She was out $14. But come on! Why can't I communicate with her with the fact that homeopathic medicine is BS and has nothing in it? Yeah, I realized a few things here. One, I didn't have a lot of experience actually talking with people about skeptical topics. I have a lot of experience talking with people about religion, atheism, humanism, things in that whole category. But the whole skepticism range, the things that scientific skepticism deals with, I actually don't have a lot of experience talking with believers there. I'm going to say that. And it showed in my interaction, I think, with my sister. I also figured that from her perspective, you know, we just went through this 15-minute car ride where I showed no understanding for her position. She was, you know, looking at things on the shelf in Walmart, seeing that, no, you can't give Tylenol to a two-year-old, you can't give this to a two-year-old, you can't give any of these things to a two-year-old. Oh, but this one's safe for children. You know, my child is sick. I want to do something so that she's less miserable, and I'm less miserable. I think she thought that too, probably, that she stops crying. Here's something that I can do for her. But the place that I was starting from did not at all address trying to make the best decisions for Emily or trying to do something to help this miserable kid. I could have been more effective if I had considered that in talking to my sister, like, I know you're trying to do the right thing. I can't believe that they market these products that are BS. You're just trying to do the best thing you can for Emily, who's miserable. You know, maybe a warm compress or steam. I don't know what, I'm not a parent. I don't know what you do for kids. But I'm sure there are other things on the internet that we can look up to help Emily feel better. We'll turn the heat up tonight, you know, have extra blankets. But that stuff, it really doesn't work. Isn't it terrible? Let's see what else we can do to help Emily. That was a big lesson for me. But again, I try to remember that it's not just about having the truth, right? Having the data. I do know from activism that people won't even accept your data until they first believe you share their values. And if I had communicated that the thing that was important to her in this instance was also important to me, and I was trying to communicate information to be helpful, I think I could have been more effective. So, skepticism. Oh yeah, one more thing. When I told her that I was going to mention this interaction in a talk I was giving, as you do, she said, oh, you're going to talk to people about how stupid your sister is? How silly you was for buying this homeopathic medicine? And I thought, no. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how silly I was for not understanding where you were coming from. And we had that conversation sometime after this happened. Again, it very much bothered me that what she got from our interaction was that I thought she was stupid and ignorant. Another important lesson for me in trying to be a better skeptic. That's what she remembered. Not that homeopathy is BS, but I think she's stupid and ignorant. We cleared that up. We're good now. On most things, we're good. But not everything. But it seems family. So now I've talked about how skepticism, the methods of skepticism, and evidence-based thinking benefit ourselves as individuals. That's why we're interested in fostering it. Benefits the people we care about, can improve our lives. I haven't really addressed clearly what the citizen part of citizen skeptic is. What is a citizen? Shout out to me. What's a citizen? Staring at me. I'm talking. You can talk. And what? A member of a society. Yeah. So thinking about skepticism and who it's good for and how we promote it. And who is a good citizen skeptic who tries to promote these things in the public sphere? There are a couple people that to me come to mind as widely known for trying to promote the methods of science and critical thinking. One is Bill Nye, this guy. How many of you watched the debate between Bill Nye and Ken Ham? Yeah. So Ken Ham, the creationist, versus Bill Nye. I think it was at a school near the Creation Museum in Kentucky. The Ham on Nye debate. Bill Nye closed that debate by saying this. I want to close by reminding everybody what's at stake here. If we abandon all that we've learned, if we abandon the process by which we know it, if we stop looking for the next answer, we in the United States will be outcompeted by other countries, other economies. That would be okay, I guess, but I was born here, I'm a patriot, and so we have to embrace science education. We have to keep science education in science. Around that time, I think, when his star really began to rise again, he started being offered a lot of platforms to talk about science and science education and evolution. He was on Meet the Press talking to Republican Representative Marsha Blackburn about climate change. And he also declared multiple times during that he is a patriot. He cares about science, and he cares about the U.S.'s investment in science and science education because he's a patriot, and he wants us to do well. He wants our economy to do well. another citizen skeptic. This will be no surprise to you. So, Neil deGrasse Tyson, how many of you watched Cosmos? How many of you did not watch Cosmos? Okay, thanks. Just checking if you were participating. In the first episode, which is one of the two episodes I watched, I think it was just when they started the first animation about Giordano Bruno, he said, Neil deGrasse Tyson says, back in 1599, everyone knew the sun, planets, and stars were just lights in the sky revolving around the Earth. It was a universe made for us. And he says later in that, there comes a time in our lives when we first realize we're not the center of the universe, that we belong to something much greater than ourselves. It's part of growing up. And as it happens to each of us, so it began to happen to our civilization in the 16th century. And then I think it's the Giordano Bruno story. Cosmos had a wide reach all over the world, and a forum on Reddit about Cosmos, the top comments were a strange mix of, this is awesome, the American president basically is introducing the show, and also it's showing in 181 countries around the world, translated in so many languages. Neil deGrasse Tyson is literally bringing the world together. We're all going to share this experience together, and I'm glad it's actually America who's doing something so positive on such a large stage. The way that I thought about the term citizen for this talk and skepticism was the way that we use the term when we say a phrase like citizen journalist. Someone who uses the tools of journalism, not necessarily a professional, often not a professional, but is active, engaged in journalism for the good of the society around them. I have more to say about this, but before I do, I'm going to show this video because it will help make my point for me. Hopefully, I will show this video.
I'm not old enough to remember 1957, but there are certainly plenty of people among us who do. And when Soviet Union launched Sputnik, that was a Sputnik moment. This was our sworn enemy, the communists, and we had our own state of self-assessment that we were technologically proficient, you know, we won the war, our manufacturing was back in place, and here's this country that we were telling the whole world that we were better than they were in every way that mattered, and bam, out comes a satellite. Our response is we created NASA. First we went berserk, then we created NASA a year later. We redoubled our efforts in science and technology and engineering, and that would shape the identity of the United States from the end of the 1950s through the 1970s. The Sputnicity of that moment, I think, comes from the fact, whether or not the public knew this, the military folks knew it, that Sputnik was a hollowed-out intercontinental ballistic missile shell. They took out the warhead and put in a radio transmitter that went beep, beep. The military folks knew that if they could put a radio transmitter in a ballistic missile shell and fly it over our heads, that they have the new high ground. So in that case, the Sputnik moment was a military one. And it was clear that technology and science would be what would enable nations to take the lead and the high ground. Right now, we in America, we're sort of slowing down. Or maybe everyone else is just speeding up. But the effect is we've lost our edge. We've lost our leadership position. When President Obama said, in a Sputnik moment, in fact, we will rejuvenate the space program. The space program, in fact, is not dead. It's just kind of smoldering back there. One of them is we'll be back to Mars in the 2030s. Maybe as early as the late 2020s. Who's going to be president? On what budget? So that's a nice thing to listen to in a speech because he's thinking about the future, But that's not a future that's actually within reach that anyone can act upon. I don't like Sputnik moments. I'd rather have been the leader all along. Why do we have to be shocked into being motivated to lead? Why don't we just lead all the time? And maybe that's just unrealistic. Maybe that's just not human nature. Maybe we have to feel threatened in order to act. So, yes, Sputnik moments work. And if we can't lead all the time, let it be a Sputnik moment that kickstarts our heart back beating again. But I can't help but be a little disappointed that we haven't stayed there, that we're going to have to play catch up if we're going to catch up at all.
Who is the we that Neil deGrasse Tyson is talking about? You can talk. The United States. Neil deGrasse Tyson often talks about wanting U.S. to be number one in science for multiple reasons, I think. And one might be the same as Bill Nye's, like he's honestly a patriot. He cares about the U.S. One might be he thinks that the U.S. has good values for the world stage. One might be that he knows his audience. He's an American. The U.S. has outsized influence in the world. If he can talk well to politicians and people who affect politicians and voters who might be interested in increasing science funding and the audiences that he's able to talk to most effectively, then that can improve science for everyone. I also worry sometimes. I've seen him give talks where he, at the end of a presentation, he'll show lines on a graph that show the U.S.'s basic science dominance in the world, having the leading universities and leading research programs and a lot of funding, and then comparing China, which has been on the rise for decades, right? And saying if we don't pay attention to science, if we don't fund these science programs, other countries will overtake us, you guys. So part of his citizen scientistism, his citizen skeptic activism, is to talk to science to try to affect science funding. Bill Nye the same. When he's on Meet the Press, particularly in the Ham on Nye debate, he was talking to a primarily Christian audience about something that they might have been disinclined to favor, science, and saying, you know, if you care about our economy, I care about our economy, I care about our country, I care about us doing well, and that's why I care about science. That kind of thing resonates. He's shaped a message for the people that he's talking to primarily, right? Right. Good. Thanks for agreeing.
I'm not enough to remember.
Psychochemical agents that temporarily change human behavior patterns. A study was made of the effect of one of these on a cat, which, prior to receiving a dose of the agent, reacted normally when confined with a mouse. When exposed to an extremely small amount of the agent, the cat's personality completely changed. Tests now in progress indicate that such agents have significant military potential. Army's research and development program is a continuing effort to help ensure the survival of this nation. Army industry teamwork is essential to the accomplishment of the Army research and development mission. To maintain superiority in our military arsenal, new ideas are essential. New weapons must be developed and perfected to meet new requirements. In these days of explosive advances in science and technology, Army research and development plays a major role in maintaining America's military supremacy.
I guess it's worth saying that all animals harmed in the filming of that video were harmed something like 68 years ago, so... So when it comes to the way that we talk about science and the fact that science and skepticism and these other values that we share are good for us and we are interested in promoting them, who is the we that we're often talking about? Why are we interested in promoting these values, and for whose benefit? So part of the way that I like us to think about the term citizen is in that context. To understand when we hear Neil deGrasse Tyson or Bill Nye talking about science, why they might give the message they do, and who might be left out of that. I usually talk about this in the context of race and sex, but I thought I'd expand it to a bigger worldwide scale. It's all relevant to each other anyway. The last story I want to share is about George Ongare, who is the executive director of the Center for Inquiry Branch in Kenya. He's been in that role and volunteering in different ways for about 10 years now there. And he writes articles online. Every few months he contributes something about skepticism, humanism, atheism, which sometimes are categories that don't split apart as cleanly as they seem to in the US in the way that we've organized our movements here. But I wanted to share part of one article that he wrote called Using Humanism to Help the Less Fortunate in Africa. He says, "When I first embraced a humanistic life stance, I believed that it was only a personal matter and that it would not compel me to trouble myself to engage in activities of social justice. Most people who have embraced a secular life stance, and mostly atheists, believe that having abandoned religion and then trying to involve themselves with activities like helping the poor, assisting orphans, and helping homeless widows is like trying to mimic religion. Hence, when one abandons the belief in God, gods, Satan, etc., it does not compel them to be involved in matters of social justice. As an atheist in Africa, that kind of thinking used to appeal to me when I was still involved with activism on campuses. I believed that my only mission was to inspire young people at the institutions of higher learning such that they would embrace rationalism in order to unwind the chains of dogma that religions and traditional societies have planted in them. This, I believed, was the only pure concern for humanists in Africa. However, this would change when in 2009, with widespread witch hunting, where old women were killed on suspicion of practicing witchcraft, children were fed poison and hacked to death for being suspected to harbor evil spirits, and women were burnt alive on accusation of witchcraft, the Center for Inquiry Transnational launched an anti-superstition campaign, encouraging African branches to empower the various communities within their operational countries by educating them on the dangers of superstition. The main aim was to instill rationality in these communities and educate them on the need to seek an evidence-based approach when it came to witchcraft. Many families were being accused of practicing witchcraft, and there was no evidence given to support these claims. Thus, because the community just relied on mere belief and hearsay when it came to witchcraft allegations, our experience showed us that this was an avenue that was used to settle family disputes over land and other resources. It troubled us so much because innocent people died, leading to a human rights crisis, and the killing of parents left children stranded without a future. Inspired by this, and through the continuous support of the Center for Inquiry, we took a different turn in our anti-superstition campaign, where our activities did not end with teaching the society about the dangers of superstitious beliefs, but we made an effort too to children who were abandoned by their parents or after their parents were lynched or died due to irrationality. That is how we started to work towards social justice and started Support a Humanist Orphan. So this campaign he started, well, these are some of the other activities he's done. His group still has lectures. This one featured Leo Igwe from a Nigerian humanist activist. This is actually a photo of a student group at the University of Nairobi that he started, that George started. The Humanist Orphans program has actually gotten recent recognition from the government, as well as some more funding from different sources, so they've been able to expand. Since they go through the use of British education system in Kenya, people are required to have uniforms to go to school, and one of the activities he's engaged in is to raise money for uniforms for orphans so that they can also attend school. One other interesting thing that George has done for the East African context in which he organizes is to take some of our materials that we send him and translate them, if I can use that word, to make sense for an African context. Here he's holding a campus organizing guide. CFI has put out a group organizing guide since the late 90s. At some point, he took our PDF and edited it. So he took out quotes by people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and some European Enlightenment thinkers and replaced some of them with African intellectuals, historical figures. He replaced some of the stories told of, there were a lot of American stories actually, with African historical stories and proverbs that would make sense so that this material could be used more effectively where he's organizing with the people he's organizing with, right? Again, know your audience. So I'll come to a close. Seeing a lot of things in this talk. So many things. But let me sum it up for you, wherever my summary is. I moved everything around with the video. Some things, I know I told a lot of stories here, and I think there's a real benefit to hearing stories from people. Hopefully we don't have to go through the same things ourselves, but we can still gain the wisdom that comes out of these experiences. I know that's useful for me. I wanted to quickly summarize some of the things I hope that you remember from this. One, which was mentioned yesterday, is that free thinking and skepticism in science are active processes. It's not just a set of conclusions. It's not being right about Bigfoot or being right about homeopathy or being right about vaccines, right? We are citizens of a world, we're members of society, and we need to function in those spaces. When we use these processes, that also involves communicating with other people, that involves having sympathy and empathy for other people, understanding where they are. These values are good for us as individuals, they're good for the people we care about, and so we should also care about communication, empathy, understanding. Free thought and skepticism are also movements working to improve people's lives. Again, it's more than just being right. There are many ways to do skeptical activism, not just joining groups or being online or arguing, but of course in interactions with our family members, our friends, members of our parenting groups, our teachers, you know, our kids. There are all kinds of ways that we want to advance these values. Know your audience, but also recognize that when you're targeting messages and trying to do the best job you can at communicating to a certain audience, it may mean you're unintentionally, or sometimes intentionally, excluding other audiences, occasionally actively harming them. All movements struggle with hubris versus humility. Activists struggle with hubris versus humility. On the one hand, if we think something's right, we want to take action based on that. We don't have time to argue about it anymore necessarily, right? But we also try to be open-minded enough to adjust what we believe. And that's very difficult. It's difficult for everyone. And last, don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Thank you again for having me here. I hope you're able to get some interesting things from my talk. I think I have time for no questions. But feel free to speak to me during the breaks or tonight later. I'll be around at the social. I'll be here all day. Thanks for your attention.